And it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
He saw a classic flying saucer, really, standing in a clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and he said, "We're not alone."
Hello and welcome to the show we call Podcast UFO. I'm Martin Willis, I'm your host, and I have some good news and bad news. I never know which one of those darn things to say first, so I'm going to say the bad news. We're not live today. Our guest, Lee Spiegel, well, he has a conflicting schedule, and we had to record ahead of time. A little more bad news, Lee and I talk so much that we're not able to leave any room for Alejandro Rojas's UFO news, but he'll be back next week. Now for the good news. I think it's a great interview, and I know you're really going to like it. I've had a lot of respect for Lee over the years. He's a real solid guy. And more good news, he will be back next month, sometime in November. I'm not sure what that date will be, but he'll be live at that point. And I'll be in the chat room live this evening, and I did mention it to Lee himself to see if he could. He is commuting while this show is live, and hopefully he's on the train. He might be able to pop in, but there's certainly no promises there. Next week, of course, we'll be back live at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. As I said last week, I plan on being at the New England UFO Conference again this year, and it's being held in Leominster, Massachusetts. And it's coming right up on the night of Friday, October 17th, and Saturday the 18th. And I will post a link on our website and our show notes. Stanton Friedman, Kathy Marden, Peter Robbins, Mark D'Antonio, the Enos, and many more. I'll be upstairs with the Enos for a good part, maybe recording with a few of the speakers there. I'm going to break down and wear my podcast UFO t-shirt, as well as my Exeter, New Hampshire UFO hat. So you'll be able to spot me easily. And please don't be shy. Come up and say hello. Well, that's it. We're ready for our interview right now with Lee Spiegel. Well, I'm on Skype with someone I've been trying to get on the show for a long time. Lee Spiegel, how are you?
I'm fine, Martin, and you haven't tried hard enough, I don't think.
Well, I did because it finally worked. Here you are.
Now, by the way, since I know we're going to become good friends, would you prefer Martin or Marty?
You know, when I was growing up, I was Marty, but I'm too old to be Marty, so we'll okay. Call me Martin if that's all right.
Martin it is, okay.
All right. You're a level-headed guy, and I've really paid attention to the work you've done. You've done some great work, and I want to know what got you started in the whole paranormal UFO subject to begin with. You've been at it a very long time.
I have. Thank you for the nice words about that. Growing up in New Hampshire, I grew up not far from where the famous Betty and Barney Hill UFO abduction case took place. Mm-hmm. So in New Hampshire, we get those crisp, amazing skies at night. You can always see weird, strange things. And also, just growing up, I was basically a child of the 50s. And so I loved being scared by all the Earth versus the Flying Saucer movies, Invaders from Mars, The Thing from Another World. I mean, I was just loving that stuff as much as it scared me. I didn't know what to make of it. I don't think I ever really considered that there might actually be people or beings coming from somewhere else with whatever reasons that they had, whether they were here to be friends with us or to eat us. I didn't care. I just liked reading about these things and seeing movies about it when I was growing up. And so I found my way to New York in 1970 from New Hampshire. I was a folk singer. And I went to New York with a suitcase and guitar. I was right out of a Paul Simon songbook. and I went to New York with the target of getting a record album deal somewhere. All folk singers, all performers want that record album deal. And so I went there and was performing for a few years. I even met a guy who wanted to be my manager, but he wanted to change my name from Lee Spiegel to Happy Day.
Wasn't there a song,
I think the Edwin Hawkins Singers, Oh Happy Day.
That's right.
And he didn't really stay as my manager very long, because I had this vision of me being introduced on stage as Happy Day with a big red clown nose and big floppy clown feet. And I thought, no, this is not the direction I want to go in. Thank you very much, but no. In 1973-74, I was working in New York as a salesperson at the big music chain franchise called Sam Ash, and lots of famous musicians would come in all the time buying all their instruments and things there, and I was selling instruments and musical things. And it was about this time, 1973, that the United States experienced what we refer to as a UFO flap or a wave. UFOs were being seen all around the country. They were showing up on news broadcasts. Even major talk shows were interviewing people. I mean, one of the first shows that I saw that featured this was the Dick Cavett Show.
Oh, yeah.
On ABC. Mm-hmm. Dick Cavett had on one of his shows a helicopter commander from the Army named Larry Coyne, who had one of the most amazing, terrifying UFO encounters of all time that involved he was the commander of a four-man Army helicopter crew. They were flying above Ohio, and they saw this object coming at them from the horizon. It was a red light, and it was on a collision course on their helicopter. Mm. And they all thought the thing was going to collide with them, and they braced for impact. And instead of the UFO colliding with them, it stopped and hovered directly above their helicopter, and they could see at that point, as it was hovering, it was a total cigar shape. It had no wings, no vertical or horizontal stabilizers, no tail, just a cigar shape. And as they were there in the helicopter, from the front of the UFO, a green light came out. It shot a beam of light into the cockpit of the copter. It bathed all of their instrument panel in a green glow. And they didn't know what to do. They were all totally scared. And then, all of a sudden, they could feel that the UFO was above them, and it started pulling them up into the sky.
Jeez.
Straight up. And they figured out that they went up something like 3,000 feet in a matter of seconds, and they didn't know it. And they were going higher and higher, and then there was a bump where the UFO apparently said, okay, I've had enough with you guys, and it let them go. And the UFO went in one direction, and the copter went in another direction, and Larry Coyne radioed ahead and said, we're coming in and have the press there. We want to tell what just happened to us. Mm-hmm. And the Army actually allowed them to talk to the media. And one of the reasons for that was because there were eyewitnesses on the ground that saw the whole thing as well. It was like, here you go, a four-man Army helicopter crew. They have this amazing encounter. We don't have anything technologically that can do what that object did, and they couldn't deny it. And so Coyne started appearing on different shows, and I saw him on the Dick Cavett Show, and I went, wow, this guy is amazing. And I kind of put that in the back of my mind, just that I was so impressed by him. And then there were other stories, and I started reading a lot of books that were available at the time, in 73, 74. One book that caught my attention was called Beyond Earth, Man's Contact with UFOs. And it was written by Ralph and Judy Blum. And Ralph, at the time, in like 74, was doing some freelance work for NBC. He was helping NBC with a primetime news special about UFOs. And so he had an office over at NBC, and he was his book as well as the show dealt with a lot of the people that had been involved with UFOs, like Donald Kehoe, astronaut Gordon Cooper, astronaut Jim McDivitt, Alan Hynek, Stan Friedman, the nuclear physicist, variety of really interesting people, and Larry Coyne, the helicopter pilot. And I loved the book because it gave me an idea that I wanted to actually hear the voices of these people talking about what they knew, what they saw, what they suspected. And so I came up with this notion, and I wanted to meet Ralph Blum, the author of the book. So knowing that he worked at NBC for the NBC news special, one day I went over to 30 Rockefeller Plaza. It was just down the street from the music store where I worked in New York. And discovered very quickly, even back then, you can't just walk through the security desk at NBC and just walk in without any kind of a badge or ID or reason to be there. So I went over to NBC and noticed that there was a crowd of people standing around getting ready to go through the security desk on their way upstairs to watch a taping of Jeopardy. Because that's where Jeopardy used to come out of. This is back in the days before Alex Trebek was the host. Back then, it was a guy named Art Fleming, and the announcer, the famous Don Pardo, was announcer. We just lost Don Pardo recently. I just went into the crowd and became part of the crowd to go to the studio, and I figured, well, while I'm in this, now that I'm past security and I'm in the building, I'll go watch Jeopardy for a few minutes. So I did, and I sat in the studio, had a good time there, and then when the show was over and it was time for the audience to leave the studio, the tour guide was saying, now everybody stay together, we're going, you know, follow us, and we'll show you how to get out of the building. So as the crowd of Jeopardy audience went down one corridor in NBC, I went down another corridor. I just walked away from the crowd. And I started looking for Ralph Blum's office in the news area of NBC until I finally found someone who said, oh yes, Mr. Blum is, you know, down in that office over there. I went into where his desk was, and I didn't even know what he looked like. I was kind of making it up as I was going along at this point. What am I going to say to him if I meet him? How am I going to figure this out? So I walked into the office, and someone said, can we help you? And I said, yes, I'm here to pick up Ralph Blum's mail.
Oh, my God. Jeez.
I didn't know where that would get me, possibly in jail. I was taking a chance that he wasn't there. And they didn't ask me any more questions. They said, hold on a minute. We have a pile of it for him. So they took his mail, wrapped it up, put it in a bag, and that, of course, gave me his address.
Oh, my God.
And luckily for me, well, I figured he must have lived in New York if he had an office at NBC. So I went to the address on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, and I rung the bell for the Blums. There was no answer. And so I rang the bell for the super of the building, and I said, I'm here to leave a pile of mail for the Blums. Can I leave it with you to get it to them? And he said, sure. I said, all right, well, hold on one second. I want to leave a note for Ralph. And I wrote a little note basically saying, hello, Mr. Blum, my name is Lee Spiegel. I love your book. I have an idea of a way that I can help you and you can help me. It's great about UFOs. Hopefully you'll call me someday to say hello. And a couple of days later, my phone rings, and this voice on the other end says, is this Lee Spiegel? And I said, yes. Who is this? Mm-hmm. He said, my name is Ralph Blum. How the hell did you get my mail?
Uh-oh.
And I said, well, you know, humana, 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 like an old Ralph Cramden. Well, yes. Mr. Blum, It was the best way I could figure to meet you. So please don't be offended. I apologize. Please just hear me out.
Jeez.
And I said, you know, I've got this great idea of taking the information that's in your book and turning it into a record album so that people could buy this record album and hear a documentary that has great voices of people talking about UFOs. Are you interested in talking to me about it? And he said, yes, let's meet.
Wow.
That's how.
You're
that's
so lucky you didn't get arrested.
Oh, of course. Of course. And when I told my father this story about how I basically broke into NBC and did this, my father said, that's my son. That is my son. Keep doing things like that.
Yeah, you'll go somewhere. And that's, yeah, that is amazing. Amazing. Did you do that to get into the Huffington Post? Something similar?
No. Actually, you know, all these years later, I had been working as an editor, a story editor, over at abcnews.com. And I was there for about 5 or 6 years. And my friend, Buck Wolf, who was a writer for ABC News, he left at one point and went over to work over at AOL. And this was about a year before AOL merged with Huffington Post. Hmm. And that was about 4 years ago. And one day when Buck was over at AOL, he called me and he said, so how happy are you still being over at ABC News? And I said, I'm not very happy at all. I can't write anything. I'm just editing other people's stories. And he said, well, listen, I have the need for someone to write UFO stories here over at AOL. Might you be interested in that? Mm. And I said, are you kidding? Yes, I'm already salivating over the idea. And I went over, and he gave me the tour of AOL. And this was like, as I said, this was a year before Huffington Post was even involved with any of this. And I spent the first year freelancing, writing stories for AOL. So I wasn't even really on staff yet. I wasn't getting benefits or company perks or anything like that. I wanted to do this so much that I didn't care mm-hmm. about the perks thing. I just wanted to be able to write and really start establishing myself as a serious writer. And then the first year came and went, and all of a sudden, Huffington Post was on the scene, and they brought in a whole new staff of people, and they made me an offer. They kept Buck and I, and they said, would you like to stay on with Huffington Post and become part of our staff and continue doing your UFO thing? And I said, yeah, absolutely. And here I am. I'm in my fifth year there now, and I have written literally hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of stories, which still blows my mind that you know, I'm knocking on wood every day at my luck to land this kind of a situation.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I didn't mean to cut you off about your album. So if you want to go back to that and just say, you know, how that all worked out. I saw that album online, so I know it happened.
It's like when Ralph Blum and I finally got together and we met and started becoming friends, with some contacts that he had, because his book was put out by Bantam Books, and we took the idea of using his book as part of the pitch. Some friends that I had in the music industry knew some people at CBS. This was back in the day when CBS had a division called Columbia House Records, and they used to advertise mm-hmm. in primetime television different record deals. Yes, right now for $8.95, we'll send you the complete works of Mantovani, all the classics. Just send an $8.95, and you know you will send you the album. Mm-hmm. And this was back in the days of vinyl albums, so. Nobody else was really doing this on TV. This was the early infomercials when they were selling products for like 2 minutes on TV. So through the contacts that Ralph had and my friends had, we got an audience at CBS where we went in to do one pitch. And the pitch was that with Ralph Blum's successful book and with my idea that I would take a really nice, back then, cassette tape recorder. And back in 1975, the smallest high-quality cassette tape recorders was about 75 pounds. It was really a mm-hmm. huge monster, and it had this newfangled switch on it called Dolby. that was the noise reduction of the day, okay? Mm-hmm. We did a pitch to CBS, and we said, I would like to go around the country, and with Ralph's help, with the people that he already knows, I will go from one place to another, and I will interview astronauts, scientists, military people, law enforcement people, people who claim to have been abducted onto UFOs. We'll put it all together, string it all together, and get a really great narrator to be the icing on the cake. And would you be willing to do this? And we can get Bantam Books involved, where we can sell the album on TV and let the audience know that if you're interested in buying this album, you'll also get the bonus book, Beyond Earth, Man's Contact with UFOs. If for some reason you don't like the album, send it back, but keep the book as our gift.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was one of those kind of deals. And CBS said, okay, we'll do it. And I went, really? you got to let me do this? They said, well, yes, it sounds like a good idea. So many pluses about this. It had never been done before. No UFO product had ever been sold on television like this before by a major company in a two-minute television commercial. It was unheard of. Hmm. And so there I was going around the country with this new heavy-duty cassette recorder, and I found myself going from one town to another, interviewing people like J. Allen Hynek, Stan Friedman, Donald Kehoe, Gordon Cooper, Jim McDivitt, and Betty Hill. I got to know Betty Hill. Just an amazing experience for a guy like me who just came out of reading books about UFOs, and now I was going around interviewing people for this
album. What year was this, would you say?
1975.
Mm-hmm.
was when I was working on the album, and the name of the album, UFOs, The Credibility Factor. And just as a little aside, that was 1975, which means that in just a few months, my album will be 40 years old. Coming up on the 40th anniversary of UFOs, The Credibility Factor, which is still relevant, and I'm in the process now of working toward remarketing and reselling it to the public once
Digital.
Again. Yes. Oh, sure.
Boy, I'd really be excited to hear that, and we'll put that on our website when you when that comes out, for sure.
Thank you so much. Now, a little bonus story here. So I'm in 1975 in April, working on my album, trying to figure out, well, where am I going to go next? Who do I have to interview? And I get a call from astronomer J. Allen Hynek. And at this point, we had started to become friends because I had already gone to Chicago to interview him for the album. And he had the Center for UFO Studies that he had created after he left the Air Force. What many people aren't aware of is that when the Air Force did its 20-year official UFO study known as Project Blue Book, J. Allen Hynek was the official scientific consultant to the Air Force for 20 years. They used to send him all around the country to look into UFO reports with a specific objective to debunk and to explain UFOs away.
Right.
That was his job with the Air Force. So then when the Air Force closed Project Blue Book in 1969, Allen Hynek then went on to create the Center for UFO Studies to continue serious UFO investigations. So he calls me in April 1975 while I'm working on my album, and he says, listen, the last couple of days, I've been getting phone calls here in Chicago from sheriff's departments, highway patrolmen, police departments. They've all been seeing a strange object in the sky at night. They don't know how to explain it. They're a little concerned about it. And they all have my hotline number where law enforcement agencies can call me here at the Center for UFO Studies. So they called me and they've asked me to help them. And he said to me, I don't have an investigator down there in North Carolina. Would you go down there and check it out for me and do some interviews with some of the officers? And if you think that there are some credible sightings and reports, you can file a report, and I'll publish your findings through the Center for UFO Studies. And I said to him, well, what is it that they're reporting? What are they calling you about? He says, well, this is something new. We haven't heard a lot about this, but they're seeing a triangular-shaped object in the sky. Hmm. And I went, really? Triangles? We really haven't heard much about that. Again, remember, that was 1975. Lately, these days, that's all you hear about are triangles now.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Okay? But this was one of the first, it turns out. I said, so it's a triangular-shaped object, and they're still seeing it. So are you saying to me, Dr. Hynek, you want me to go down to North Carolina and investigate flying Doritos? Because that's what this sounds like. He said, well, yes, I guess that's what I'm asking you to do. I said, really? Can't you send me someplace where I can actually see a classic flying saucer? I'd really like to see that. He said, look, if you don't want to go, I'll find someone else. And I went, no, are you kidding? I'm going to turn down a request from J. Allen Hynek to go. Basically, you're making an appointment for me to see this thing. I'm going. and I went and got down to North Carolina, flew into Fayetteville, and then someone from the sheriff's department came and picked me up and drove me down to Lumberton. And within a few hours of my arrival, I was in the sheriff's office. The calls started coming in.
Really?
And yeah, it was like clockwork. And there were newspaper accounts. I can even send you these things. I have all the original newspaper accounts that said, you know, Dr. J. Allen Hynek in Chicago is sending a New York City UFO investigator here to explain all this away. And so I was there, and I got into one of the sheriff's cars with an officer, and out we went. And we kept in contact with other law enforcement officers in cars through the car radios. And a few minutes later, we all converged in front of this big field. And everybody got out of the cars, turned the car engines off. It was already dark, lots of stars, no moon. Just stars, and the only sound that we could hear, the sound of animals, nervous animals in the area, nervous because they knew something was up. And as we looked across the field, from our left moving toward the right, just above a line of trees, was a red light and then a white light. It was alternating, red, white, moving just very slowly, moving along above the trees. And then when it got to the point where it was right directly across the field from us, it stopped moving, and then it changed its direction and started moving directly across the field toward where we were standing. There were other expletives that I used. And a few other words. And it came across the field very slowly, very deliberately, no sound, until it stopped and parked itself right in the sky above us. And it was at that point that we could clearly see that it was the shape of a triangle, because it had a row of white lights up one side of it and a row of red lights up the other side of it. And at the apex where these two sides actually met, there was a bigger, brighter light.
Boy, you know, they hear that a lot.
Yeah. So this thing literally was just hovering there. And like I said, it had no engine. There was no sound whatsoever.
Would you guess size of this thing and the height of it?
Someone thought that it was maybe a couple of hundred yards in the sky above us. And it was then determined by one of the officers that it didn't look like it was much bigger than if you put a couple of the police cars together. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't a gigantic ship or object, but it was still just sitting there in the sky, not doing anything. And I remember thinking that I felt really pretty safe and confident because I'm surrounded by police officers and they've got their six shooters ready to go into action. And then I caught myself and I went, wait a minute, really, how safe do I feel if this thing is here to eat us? Do you think some six shooters are going to do any good? No. So all of these thoughts, you know, were probably also going on in their minds too. And as we watched it, out of the brighter light on the object, a beam of light came down from the object and surrounded us where we were standing.
Jeez.
Just came right out of it, came right down, and it was so bright, it was like a magnesium flare that you often see at construction sites where you can't really look right at it. Mm. It was that kind of blinding light. It must have lasted maybe 2-3 seconds at the most, and then the light went right back into the craft, and then the whole thing, all the lights on the craft turned off, and the entire object became like an amber color.
Wow.
And it very slowly did about a 45-degree turn and then slowly started moving off in another direction as if to say, I'm done with you guys. I'm going somewhere else now, okay? And that's what it did. And we get into the cars and we started tracking it and following it through a couple of different counties. And every place we stopped, we found other police officials who had just had their own encounter with it. I stopped at one place, spoke to Police Chief Gary Moore, who had been sitting in his car near a lake. And he said that while he was sitting there, the whole inside of his car just lit up. Gee, isn't that familiar, like what happened with the helicopter pilot from 1973? And I said, well, what did you do? He said, I just kind of leaned out the car window and looked up. Very reminiscent of Richard Dreyfuss in Close Encounters of the Third Kind, okay? But this was 3 years before that movie came out. Actually, 2 years before the movie. He looked up, and he saw this thing just sitting in the sky above him. He got out of his car, went to his trunk, and he pulled out one of those big old law enforcement lanterns that they use for emergencies. Mm-hmm. He pointed the lantern up to the object, and he blinked the light, and he said the object blinked back at him once.
Boy, you hear that.
I said, so what else did you do? He said, well, I blinked twice, and it blinked twice back at me. Again, 2 years later, you think about the mothership that comes down in Close Encounters, and they have that whole communication at the end between the mothership and the music.
Yeah, have you ever heard of the Father Gill sighting?
Oh, yeah, Papua New Guinea.
That's right,
oh, yes.
Yeah. Their interaction there, there's a number of times you hear there's interaction, which is amazing.
Yeah, it is amazing. It was a great encounter. I got a lot of great interviews, sent the report back to Alan Hynek. I called up, I think it was Pope Air Force Base outside of Fayetteville, just to see if they'd had anything in the sky that night. And, of course, they said no. Put all the pieces together, and it was eventually, it was written up, and it was published by the Center for UFO Studies. So there's my personal close encounter. You know, it's the kind of thing where you never forget it after it happens. It's so dramatic. Mm-hmm. And they didn't come to eat me.
It seems like you were already really into the topic before you even showed up there, but did it change anything in your life?
No. It just made me more aggressive about wanting to find out what this stuff was about. Mm-hmm. And this was also at a point where my attitude was, and mostly because of things that Stanton Friedman, the nuclear physicist, had said to me ever since 1975, 74, thereabouts, right to this very day, all these years later, Stan Friedman is still consistently saying to groups and lectures that he goes to, he definitely believes that some UFOs are somebody else's extraterrestrial, intelligently controlled spacecraft. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't waver from that at all. And so for the longest time, I was believing that too, even though so many scientists, mainstream scientists, will say, well, that can't be true. Nobody's visiting us. There's no evidence. They can't possibly get here from mm-hmm. wherever they might be coming from. The distances are too great, blah, 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 I say to them. Mm-hmm. Even in the book, the novel, and then the movie Contact, that was written by Carl Sagan, even a conservative guy like Sagan was speculating on the possibility that, you know, if you take any civilization that might be, let's conservatively say 500 years ahead of us, 1,000 years ahead of us technologically, don't you think it's possible that they have figured out how to leapfrog over the great distances that everybody else is saying it can't be done? Mm-hmm. Stan Friedman always loves to say in his lectures, and I'm always repeating this, and he's so right. He says, when somebody says that bit of UFO behavior is impossible, what they're really saying is, I don't know how to do that. And if I don't know how to do it, well, then it must be impossible.
Yeah.
And there's the attitude right there. Mm-hmm. It's the same attitude as, gee, once, not that long ago in our history, once the Earth was the center of the universe, and everybody believed it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, science over a period of time, we learn through doing that. Things change, concepts change, beliefs change, that what we think is impossible now, we know it's probably going to change and become the possible. And many scientists are now coming around to that idea, especially physicists who are talking about other dimensional realities around us, where mm-hmm. some of these UFOs might not be coming from very far away. They could be coming from very close by. There are so many stories where eyewitnesses report a UFO just suddenly appeared out of nowhere
and fades away.
Yep. And then fades away out of nowhere into nowhere. Well, what is the technology? What is that? It sounds like, if you keep it simple, someone knows how to slip into and out of other spaces. Why should we have a problem believing that? There are too many possibilities out there. Even a very conservative astronomer like Seth Shostak, he's the senior at the SETI Institute.
He's been on a couple of times.
Okay. Yeah. Seth, just a couple of weeks ago, was one of the main speakers at the NASA Astrobiology Symposium at the Library of Congress. And there were many people invited to speak there, including astronomers from the Vatican. Mm-hmm. And among the things that Seth said were some staggering numbers. And we know these numbers now to be pretty close to fact, mostly from two little wonderful devices, one called the Hubble Space Telescope, the other one called the Kepler spacecraft. Mm-hmm. I like to refer to Kepler as the little spacecraft that could.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
It's like, wow. Kepler has already discovered, which have now been confirmed, more than 1,400 new planets. Mm. And Hubble has... earlier this year, I'm not sure if you saw this, but NASA released an image that NASA says is probably the greatest, most incredible image that Hubble has ever taken.
It's a deep space one?
It's a deep space that shows 10,000 galaxies.
Right. Amazing.
In just this one little moment in space. And based on those kinds of numbers, now astronomers are saying, and here are the numbers that Seth Shostak was throwing out to the people in Washington. now, he says, now we know, we're pretty sure there are billions of galaxies, that we think there might be as many as 100 billion galaxies. And those galaxies are made up of hundreds of billions of stars or suns. And we now believe that many, if not most of those suns, have planets around them. And so bringing it down to our galaxy, he says, so let's just consider the numbers in our galaxy. The little Milky Way galaxy that has maybe 100 billion stars. We can conservatively estimate, he says, with all those numbers and all the possible planets out there, that there could be in the Milky Way galaxy as many as 50 billion habitable planets.
Isn't that amazing?
Wow. It's so difficult for us to
understand the number.
Exactly. How do we absorb that? What do we do with that information? And leave it to the Vatican. Vatican astronomers are now saying that if it turns out that we do have brothers and sisters out there, we have no problem with that.
Right.
Because to us, it just proves that God has a bigger dominion where life flourishes. Don't you love it?
One of the fathers there from the Vatican said a couple of pretty interesting things at that meeting. Can you touch on that?
Jesuit brother Guy Consolmagno. And he first started this ball rolling even a few years ago, where he just came out and said, look, we have no problem with there being brothers and sisters from the stars. And in fact, we would be happy to baptize any extraterrestrials, but they'd have to ask us first. and to take it a step further, Martin, just a few months ago, and this... Everybody went crazy about this. This went viral instantly. During one of Pope Francis's Monday morning services at the Vatican, he said, and nobody asked him to say this, he just blurted this out. He said, you know, if we were to be visited tomorrow by Martians, and he actually used the word Martians. he didn't say ETs or aliens or extraterrestrials. He was focusing right in on Mars. Okay, he said if Martians were to come here, and were to ask us to baptize them, he said, who am I to refuse them?
Wow.
Like, wow, are you kidding? And I say to people in lectures that I do and presentations, I say to people, do you folks even know that the Vatican has not one, but two astronomical observatories,
right?
One in Italy and one on a mountain peak in Arizona. And they have Jesuit brothers who are astronomers. And so the question that I like to raise is, what are they looking for?
Right.
You know?
You know, there was a claim I heard, I don't know if it was on Coast to Coast or somewhere, where they were saying that out of those observatories, they actually saw signs of life. Did you ever hear of anything?
No, I hadn't heard that. That's a good one. I like that. I know, like, Brother Guy, his main area of expertise is studying meteorites. Hmm. Because they're very interested in this, they're very interested in asteroids, because they want to know, they're concerned that some asteroids get a little too close to Earth,
mm-hmm.
And so far as we know, we haven't been told, but it does not appear as if Earth has any real defense against an incoming asteroid.
Mm.
I mean, there are things out there that we as Earthlings should be banding together to take care of each other. But we're not doing that.
You know, and it seems like whatever the amount of money that would be spent to protect us from something like that would be well worth it. But there's no money.
Of course. You're absolutely right. You know, all the money that's spent on new stealth bomber technology, you know, so we can have the upper hand on all other military organizations. Really, folks, really? Are we still the kind of planetary species that is concerned about this? And people wonder, people say, well, why don't the aliens or whoever they are and where they come from, why don't they just show themselves and say, you know, here we are, let's all be one big happy family. Are you kidding? With all the radio signals going out, with all the television signals, with all the rockets that we've been sending out there, it's quite obvious. It would be very obvious that to other civilizations, we are a dangerous planet.
We're a little violent.
We don't deserve to be invited into the Federation of Planets yet.
now that we're speaking on this topic, yeah. I'm sure you've heard Robert Hastings talking a lot about, and you know, Bob Salas's account, who, by the way, will be on next week. I think I wrote you an email that I heard a number of years ago from someone that I'm saying 25 years ago that he was talking about this, that they were interested in our nuclear arms.
Absolutely. And yet the government, the military, will always deny this kind of thing. And, you know, lately my attitude has been changing a little bit about the whole conspiracy theory about UFOs and extraterrestrials, and why would they lie to us? Why wouldn't they tell us the truth? And my feeling is, I actually think that the not telling us is okay, because I'm a believer now that not just the United States, but the governments of the world may not know the full picture of what's happened.
I've said that a few times. I agree with you.
Yeah, because, and even guys like Jacques Vallée, John Alexander, people who I really admire and respect, they will say to you, this is a very complex situation. It's not just somebody seeing lights in the sky that look like they're in the shape of a triangle. It may have something to do with more and more abduction experiences that people claim to have. Not everybody is lying about their experiences. Not everybody is making it up. Not everybody is hallucinating. It gets to a point where you have to keep it really simple. And my belief is that the government doesn't fully know. There are people who are claiming that at some point decades ago, that the United States government made a deal with extraterrestrials to allow them to abduct some of our people, some of our citizens, in exchange for new technology.
You know what? I gotta stop you right here for a second, because I have a friend from Russia who just told me this afternoon that they heard the very same exact story in Russia back in the 1950s.
Uh-huh.
And it was for the exact thing, in exchange for technology.
And the more you hear these kinds of stories, my belief gets stronger in that, how can the government or any government tell the population that this may be going on? That would cause more panic than anything like UFOs just appearing everywhere all at once. The idea that there could be an agreement between Earth's leaders and extraterrestrials to actually take some of our people, like, really? So I don't know if that's true. A couple of years ago, I did an interview, one of many interviews, with my friend Nick Pope. Mm-hmm. And your listeners probably know who Nick is. He for 3 years in the 1990s, he was running what was called the UFO Office of the Ministry of Defense in England. And he and I were talking about various things. His responsibility was to read through and go through every UFO report that came across his desk, and he was told that in every way, form, fashion that he could, to contact the media and to make these stories go away and to explain them all the best way possible. And he said, and we called this process spin and dirty tricks. And I said, what does that mean, spin and dirty tricks? He said, we were charged, I was charged with making these UFO stories go away, just like the Air Force was with Project Blue Book. So I took it a step further and I said, all right, what does that entail, making it go away? And Nick said to me, well, it was part of my responsibility, part of my job, to ridicule people, to deny that these things that they claim that they saw, to deny that it ever happened, to make them feel foolish, and to, in some cases, even ruin their lives because they dared to speak out about something that they experienced or that they saw. And I said, Nick, that's a terrible thing that you did. Mm-hmm. And that even the United States, the famous Robertson panel, right, committee that Dr. J. Allen Hynek was a part of. Part of what they were supposed to do was to make UFO stories go away.
Ridicule.
Mm-hmm. Ridicule people. So I said to Nick, what was behind that? Why did you do these spin and dirty tricks? He said, well, it was very simple. We were at a time when many people were reporting things in the skies, including airline pilots. There was a possibility of airline safety that could become an issue. And the British government could not figure out a way to tell the population that there were things operating in our skies that we had no control over, that we could not catch, we could not pin them down, we couldn't even chase them. We couldn't tell the public that we were having this problem. So we were then told to just ridicule all the sightings instead. You know, like, end of story, really. Yeah. You know, and to some degree, Martin, I hate to say this, and people would get pissed at me, but I don't care. I can almost understand why governments would do that. If you know, your Air Force is charged with the safety and the security of your nation, especially from the mm-hmm. skies, and if something is coming in and out of your airspace that you cannot control or have any power over, of course people will get nervous and afraid of that. So to get around that, you do what you can to try and make people think that there's nothing to it.
Just like back in 1952. And that speech.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. Yeah, so I get that. I get the attitude that's what's probably going on. You hear all these people talking about, well, there's like another government that's controlling things. If you don't, it's at the highest level, and the president of the United States doesn't have a need to know, et cetera, et cetera. Well, that may very well be. The president may not have I need to know, that there are other people that are controlling the government. Well, maybe that's true. Somebody is controlling something. Mm-hmm. It's like Jacques Vallée, in some of the earlier books that he wrote, a very smart, very, very smart thinker about UFOs, would consider that the whole UFO phenomenon has something to do with projections, that something is being projected into our reality, to play tricks on us, to show themselves. And I once said to Jacques, well, if that's true, who's running the projector?
Right.
You know, I mean, you can take this step as far as you want, and really going all the way back thousands of years ago, early UFO encounters. In my presentations, I do a thing at the beginning of my talk where I say to people, UFO reports, I say that I feel like I'm very proud to be part of a profession that reports and tries to get accurate information out to the public about UFOs. And it's a profession that goes all the way back to the time when humans before there were newspapers and television and radios, humans still wanted to report the things that went on in their daily lives, so they painted these things onto cave walls.
You know, you talk about Seth Shostak. I mentioned that to him. We had sort of a UFO debate, and and he said, well, my kids were drawing stuff like that, too. He didn't want to admit it. So I agree, and I've said a number of times, and not to be redundant on this show, but the way the timings go with civilizations, advanced civilizations that are possibly out there, they could have been visiting us millions of years ago. You know what I mean? It wouldn't make any difference, really, in the scope of things.
That's right. There was a thing that just happened in the news just this week. I forget where the cave was, but some cave was discovered, and there were pictures showing what are apparently the oldest ever paintings of hands and arms dating back 40,000 years.
Oh, yes. I saw that.
Mm-hmm. Just in the news this week. Mm-hmm. And so I like to say to audiences, here in New York, where I live, we have this very famous paper, the New York Times, and its motto has always been, all the news that's fit to print. Well, I say they stole that motto from early cave dwellers who basically did all the news that's fit to paint.
Yeah, exactly. Hey, Lee, I got a question. I'm going to put you right on the spot.
Okay, do it.
Will you come back on?
Well, let's see. You're going to have your people call my people.
And your publicist is a dick, by the way.
My publicist is a dick.
No, that's. I hope you come back on because I feel like I just scratched the surface and we're out of time.
Well, I would love to come back because obviously we should get into how I brought the UFOs to the United Nations. And that was a whole.
Yes, I wanted
story
to talk about that. And where can someone find your website? And of course, on the Huffington Post.
Right. Well, you know, they can go to leespiegel.com, and you can spell Lee and Spiegel any way you want. You'll get to my webpage. There are some interesting things about a variety of things that I did so far to help get more information out about UFOs. Huffington Post, my direct email there. If people want to contact me, it's lee.spiegel, and that's S-P-E-I-G-E-L. At HuffingtonPost.com, and you can find out what I'm up to with my stories. And Martin, thank you. It's about time that you and I had a chance to talk.
That's right. All right, Lee. Until next time, I'm going to say.
I go along with you, and really, you don't have your people call me. We'll just do it.
All right. Sounds good. All right, that's it for our show. We'll be back next week live with Peter Robbins and Robert Salas. I want to thank people for helping out with the show today. Keith Rowland for producing the Dark Matter Radio Network. Our guest, of course, Lee Spiegel. I want to thank Peggy Shunning for adminning the Facebook page. And if you want to get all the latest UFO news and astronomy news, check us out on Facebook and like us. Thanks again, and we'll see you right here on the Dark Matter Radio Network next week. And keep your eyes to the sky.